Emily Oxford listened to my podcast. Holy crap! It's Rise of the Rune Lords. So today, year of our Lord, January 19th, 2023, not another D&D podcast released their first Pathfinder 2nd edition episode called Behind the Screens Pathfinder 2E. And I was amazed to find out that they listened to my podcast to learn it. Or at least Emily did. I mean, the rest of them could have listened to it by now for all I know, but Emily for sure confirmed that she did. And to me, that's just like, that's the mind explosion sound. All of them have been on College Humor at various points. I grew up, it feels like, with Jake Hurwitz. I'm sorry if that makes Jake feel old, but also Dimension 20 is my favorite actual play podcast. Both Emily Axford and Brian Murphy are on there, and they're always amazing. Emily especially is like super funny and chaotic, and to find out that she learned Pathfinder 2nd edition in part by listening to this podcast is just a tremendous honor. Now, who's to say if any of them are still listening to it, even Emily, but if you are, thank you so much for taking this dive into Pathfinder 2E with me, and thank you for shouting out my podcast, and thank you to anyone who came here as a result of that shout out. You are going to have a really good time with Pathfinder 2nd edition, and I really hope that my podcast helps you get there. I am recording this episode both as a thank you on the off chance that she or any of the cast is still listening to say thank you. This is the only way that I will ever possibly get a message to them, but also to respond to some of the questions, some of the comments that they had on the podcast. I know Emily specifically said, be patient with me, and this is far from me putting her on blast. In fact, she got so much right, which I think is a testament to how easy it can be to learn Pathfinder 2nd edition from either coming from 5e or having no experience with tabletop RPGs at all. There's a couple very minor corrections to make. There's a lot more to expound on because what they touched on is, you know, kind of touching the surface, and it can be a lot cooler to dive deeper into it. If you're here from the NAD Nation, I really encourage you to listen to my other episodes, which go much more in depth into these topics. I'm just going to try to be brief as possible in and out of this episode, not try to make it too long, because again, there's really not a lot of wrong things in what she or any of them said. There's just ways to make it cooler. I'm just going to quote what they said rather than play voice clips, because you have probably listened to that episode, and if you haven't, you should, if you are from my podcast and you haven't listened to Not Another D&D Podcast. It was very well produced, very funny. I enjoyed it a lot, not just because they mentioned me, even if they were just talking about 2E, I still had a really good time listening to them talk about it. They had a really good impression of it. So go check out that episode and then listen to this one. So without further ado, let's get started. So one of the first things that Emily mentioned was that she felt that she wouldn't need to multi-class because whenever she did, she was trying to fit a vibe. That is very true. You could go a lifetime just playing the core classes as they are. However, for you D&D fans who love your subclasses, let me introduce you to archetypes. Archetypes do just what Emily was looking for, give you flavor beyond what the core classes can do. Not only could you multi-class as two of the classes, such as being a barbarian and a bard at the same time, you can also choose any number of over 100 different archetypes. There are ones like Bounty Hunter, Chrono Skimmer, Geomancer, Hell Knight, even Vampire. Emily's character in A Court of Fae and Flowers, Lady Chirp Featherfowl, is, according to the wiki, a wizard and bladesinger. Wizard, obviously, grants tons and tons of spells. Bladesinger is someone who channels magic into devastating attacks and cunning defenses. Playing the same character in Pathfinder 2E, she could have accomplished the same thing probably just with the Magus. The Magus is an arcane spellcaster with martial ability, able to infuse spells into their weapons in the form of a spell strike. That's just the core class, and she could have used roleplay to do all the rest, but she could have taken an archetype. One I think could have fit her character very well is the Dandy archetype. a genteel master of style, culture, and decorum, with feats like distracting flattery, gossip lore, and party crashers. Yes, absolutely, didn't need to go much further than the core class, but there are still all of those cool options. The next thing I wanted to talk about is the levels of success. Emily got this right in her description. 10 over a DC is a critical success, 10 less than a DC is a critical failure. The numbers in between are normal failures and normal successes. Now, the one thing that I wanted to clarify specifically about spells, they brought up the example of Burning Hands. And yes, absolutely, when you roll a critical success against Burning Hands, meaning you succeed at your reflex save, then you're not going to take any damage. If you succeed, you'll take half. If you fail, you'll take full. And if you critically fail, you'll take double. Those are the cases for basic saves. That word basic is very important. Having that word basic in front of the saving throw means that that is the template of damage dealing that's going to deal every single time. The double, full, half, and none spectrum. However, there are plenty of spells and abilities that also have those various degrees of success, but each level of success has a different thing happen to the creature, a different unique thing. As an example, the spell Blister, which the various degrees of success dictate how many blisters you grow on your body, and if you pop any of them, then targets in a 15-foot cone take 7d6 acid damage. So a success deals 1, a failure deals 2 blisters, and on a critical failure, the target grows 4 blisters. So still correct, just expounding that there is a lot more to the critical level of success than just damage deal. Now, one of the questions that got brought up that Emily didn't know was, does anything bad happen to you on a normal attack, like with a sword or an axe, if you critically fail? And the answer is no, unless you are using the critical fumble deck, which I do not recommend using. So while that's true for strikes, that a critical failure will not do anything worse to the person or anything better for the creature that you're striking against, there are certain abilities that have the attack trait that do have worse effects for a critical failure. So for an example, a big one is grapple. It has the attack trait, meaning that it is subject to the multiple attack penalty. Now, this also has the various degrees of success. Normal success, they are grabbed, meaning that they can't go anywhere. If you critically succeed, then they're restrained, meaning that they can only try to escape on their turn until they do. On a failure, you don't get anything. But on a critical failure, not only does the creature that you had grabbed escape, they can grab you or trip you. So, again, not wrong, just a clarification that I wanted to add. Now, something else that got brought up is if a natural 20 is an automatic success. Now, natural 20s have the weird caveat, as do natural ones, that it increases the level of success by 1 degree. Natural ones have the opposite, where it decreases the level of success by 1. Why is this a good thing? Why should you rather go with this than have natural 20s always be automatic successes and ones be automatic failures? I'm going to give you 2 examples. First, with Tree Razor, and the other with Animated Brooms. Tree Razor is a completely unique Pathfinder monster. I think it was one of the developers' childhood monsters that they drew doodles of and then brought into the game. It's a level 25 monster in 2nd edition, which is the same level as the dreaded Tarrasque. In fact, they're the only 2 monsters that are that high at that level. Now, it has an AC of 54. That is beatable, but it's very, very hard, and it's especially going to be hard to get 10 above that number. Even at a 20, if you just do the math right, you might not always reach the 54. So, bringing it up, that level of success, where you're able to beat the AC, but you rolled a 20, making it into a critical success can make a really big difference in the game. Now, in that example, yes, that is basically what they just asked. Why not just make nat 20s critical successes? And this is where the reverse comes into play. When natural 20s are being used against the players, So let's work from a hypothetical. A level 20 party is the highest that you can get. They are basically demigods at that point. Now, there are very weak creatures in second edition, one of them being the animated broom, which is a minus one level creature. So that is literally as easy as it could get. In fact, I calculated it out with the 2E encounter budget system, how many animated brooms it would take to have an extreme encounter with a level 20 party. Now, extreme encounters are the worst of the worst kind of encounters that you'd have. With the XP math, an animated broom would be worth 0.02929 6875 experience points for the experience budget table. That means it would take 5,461 animated brooms to have an extreme level encounter for a level 20 party. Now, there is no way where even if an animated broom rolled a natural 20 that it would ever be able to beat the AC of even the weakest level 20 player character. But if you make natural 20s auto hit, even if those hits aren't double damage, that means one in every 20 of those animated brooms has a chance to succeed, not just once, possibly even three times, each dealing 1d4 bludgeoning plus their little dust ability, which might not sound like a lot, but that is still about 1,092 animated brooms still hitting you. Even a level 20 party would have trouble with that. So it's not just there for the benefit of the players to always feel like they are able to succeed, but also to protect the players so that especially weak creatures aren't able to take away the fantasy of the growth of the players away just because they hit a natural 20. Any roll that a animated broom would make against a player character would probably be a critical failure just by math. Even a natural 20, which would only raise the degree of success up to a normal failure, still meaning that those brooms wouldn't be able to hit the players. In any balanced encounter, a natural 20 should be a critical success. It's when you reach those unbalanced encounters that you really want to have that degree of success that a nat 1 and a nat 20 provide on your side. The real cool moments with those nat 20s isn't when your nat 20 critically hits. It's when it saves you. Because yes, absolutely, it would be much more satisfying that every nat 20 for a player is that critical success. However, by the math, if a 20 plus whatever your modifier is wouldn't beat the DC, never gonna happen. That nat 20 can raise the level of success from a failure to a success. And to me, that is a true heroic moment. If you always have that safety blanket, knowing that you could not only succeed, but critically succeed at everything, no matter what, to me that takes out a bit of the anticipation, the risk of the game. But how much cooler would a moment be if you couldn't hit something? If everything that you tried never, ever worked, that it was basically impossible to beat the DC of whatever challenge that you're facing. But then you get that one natural 20, and it is just enough for you to hit the bad guy, for you to grab the edge of a cliff. That to me is a moment where the whole group would be standing on the edge of their seat and cheering when they get that result. But that's just my little take on it. The next topic is about the three action economy, which I am so glad to hear that they not only loved, but recognized that just attack, attack, attack is not necessarily the best way to go about it. It's certainly a way to go about it, but there are better ways to use your action economy. Now, one thing that was noted was, could you use the force open action to open up a gator's maw and then shove a javelin in there? The answer is, maybe. Technically, force open is a move to use on objects, doors, chests, jail cells, things like that. That said, the tagline of my podcast is "Don't let the rules rule you," which is in reference to the first rule of Pathfinder, which is that this game is yours. If there is not an exact rule, you can make one up. And when you do have to do that, Pathfinder provides just as good a mechanism to do that as having the written out actions. So there might not be an explicit grab a crocodile's jaw and open it up action. That said, there are DCs by level, and hopefully your GM is good and creative. Now, if I was your GM, and God, that would be so freaking cool, I very well might use the Force Open action as a template to help the player accomplish what they want to do. Or I could use Table 10-5, DCs by level, and make up a DC. This is a big difference that I have heard between Dungeons & Dragons and Pathfinder, which is that D&D doesn't provide clear guidelines for when you just need to make something up. They just kind of expect the DM to do it. But in Pathfinder, they provide tables for everything. The DC by level table is particularly good because you can match the DC to the level of your player characters to find an adequate level for the DC. Let's go back to the crocodile. That is a level 2 creature. Now I can go to table 10-5, look up what the DC for level 2 is, being 16. I can then easily adjust that table with rules that Pathfinder has already provided. I can add plus 2 to make it a little bit harder and plus 5 to make it very hard. Similarly, I can subtract 2 to make it easier and minus 5 to make it very easy. With crocodiles having a bite force of 3,700 pounds per square inch, we're probably going to make this a very hard DC, meaning that I could easily set the DC for opening up the maw to DC 21. Now that is still a balanced DC. A player would be able to reach it at the level that they are encountering a crocodile. So even if there isn't a set move, a set action, a set DC for the specific thing that a player wants to accomplish, Pathfinder still gives you the tools to make it happen. But the crucial thing that the whole cast saw was that it is more important to try to diversify your actions and not just always attack and attack and attack. Giving your fellow players bonuses, like moving as one of your actions so that you can give them flanking, or doing things that give creatures penalties, like doing the demoralize action, can radically change and improve combat for everyone. A single successful demoralize makes a creature frightened 1 until the end of their next turn. Frightened 1 alone reduces their AC by 1, their DCs by 1, their attacks by 1. It overall makes for a weaker creature, and the demoralize action does not suffer the multiple attack penalty. So yes, fighters, hit them twice, but then just scream at the creature. It could make it easier for everyone else to hit them. That is the true dynamic of the three action economy, and I am so happy that they saw that. The next thing I wanted to point out was a tiny little thing that Emily mentioned, but it's really important, I think, especially to new players who see the giant core rulebook, which is that the rules for the game of Pathfinder 2nd Edition are only 38 pages long. Emily said 40, but that is a mere 6% of the entire book. Yes, look at this giant book in front of you. Realize that only a tiny fraction of that is actually about playing the game. Everything else is options. All of the ancestries, all of the classes, all the skills, feats, equipment, and spells that you can take. An additional 8% of the book is about game mastering. So yes, technically the rules are more than 38 pages, but they're not really the rules that players have to know in order to play. They're all of those tables that I was talking about. And most of the game mastery section is honestly just good advice. I only wanted to bring special attention to it, not because Emily was 2 pages off, that would be ridiculous, but because I think it's a really important thing to note that this book is not as unwieldy as it looks on its face. These rules could easily be condensed down into much smaller books, and in fact are, in the Pathfinder Primer on Pathfinder Nexus, as well as the player and game mastery guides found within the beginner box. They are both far smaller than the entire core rulebook, but provide the exact same rules. Another concern that the cast had was, how does Pathfinder 2e work in Theater of the Mind? 2e is a very combat-focused game, which can feel like it needs maps and pawns, and they definitely do make it easier, no question about that. That said, I have successfully run Pathfinder 2nd Edition in Theater of the Mind. A way that I have found success in running combat without maps or minis is to describe things in terms of stride distance. Most creatures have a movement speed of 25. Some might have a little bit more depending on the ancestry or certain beats that they choose. But if you say a monster is 40 feet away, that's going to take 2 actions regardless of if a creature's movement speed is 30 feet, 25 feet, or even 35 feet. There is admittedly difficulty with things like cones, spheres, but no more than there is in D&D, which uses the same kind of geometry. So we're halfway through their podcast, and already you can see I haven't had to do any kind of corrections really at all. There's just like a couple little clarifications, but Emily got everything right. So now we move on to the next part of their podcast, which was Emily's three hard to swallow pills. Let's spend a little time on those. The first is that based on some of her research, it seems that spellcasters can feel underwhelming compared to marshals. So the real question is, are spellcasters there just to buff their friends and debuff their enemies? And I think I don't actually have much of an opinion on this, mostly because I never get to play because I'm a forever GM. What I will say though, as a GM, as the person who takes the brunt of whatever the players dish out, I have never felt that spellcasters are less than the marshals. Rather, spellcasters have very much been able to ruin my bad guy's day. In just one of my combats in Fist of the Ruby Phoenix, I had a player who trapped one of the opposite team members in an igloo, then had another one who did tentacles all over the field, then another one who slowed a creature down, which meant that he couldn't do attacks of opportunity, which was his whole shtick. Plus, had a spell that gave the players advantage and disadvantage, which I was going to talk about a little bit later, and turned someone else invisible so that I could never find them or hit them when they were shooting arrows at all of my enemies. None of those spells are offensive, meaning inherently damage dealing. Of course, those spells do exist, like Disintegrate, Electric Arc, Hydraulic Push, and Fireball. But I would say those other things are the fun magic. And that's just my perspective. If people want to just blast things and you know, essentially just be a shooty gun of magic, that's fine. Like, I hesitate to bring up Harry Potter because, you know, fuck turfs. But when you compare the magic in the books to the magic of the movies, in the books, they were turning people's heads into babies, making statues move, turning shelves into feathers, like doing all kinds of creative things in that combat where it wasn't just blasty shooty force. It was like real magic manipulating things around them into other things. In the movies, all you really saw was them just doing like psh, 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 from a wand. To me, that's not really magic. It's a form of magic. It's a valuable form of magic. You definitely want to have your spellcasters be able to do a hit every once in a while. But I think it's largely a matter of perspective about if those things that aren't inherently damage dealing are still fun. And I would argue that they are. And to the other point about, are there half-casters? Yes. Champion is one of them that has the ability to either be a full marshal or have some spells. They can have traditional spells, like heal is a big one that they usually have. Or they can have my favorite kind of spell, which is focus spells. Part of why I think spellcasters feel a little bit limited is because of the system of spellcasting that Pathfinder uses. Someone told me how it was pronounced right, but Vanakin, something like that. But it's the idea of spell slots. With focus spells, they are points that you can get back out of combat, and then you're able to use them again in other combats. Different classes use focus points differently. For monks, they use it for ki. For witches, they use it for hexes. Oracles use them for their special powers that they get from whatever weird force they get them from. And I love those because you're not afraid to use them. With spell slots, you have to be a little conservative with how you use them. And that's true whether it's D&D or Pathfinder. You only have so many fireballs that you can cast in a day. So you want to make sure that you cast the fireballs at the right time of the day, which can mean that spellcasters in 2E largely go into their cantrips, which they can cast as many times as they want every day. Could the system be better? Sure. But that's my two cents on why some spellcasters might feel feel that way. A little bit later in this discussion, they're talking about it would be really useful if they could have a chart of the different actions that they could use and be able to focus on that. And I am so jazzed to be able to tell you that that already exists. On Archives of Nethys, if you go under the rules section, you'll see that there is a place called actions/activities. When you click on that, you'll have all of the actions available to every single character, regardless of class. So then the only other ones that you would have to know are the ones that are granted by your feats or your spells. Paizo sells some really useful spell cards so that you could choose your spells, pull out those cards, and then just have those cards on the table next to you. Or since you already mentioned that you are using Path Builder to build your characters, they have all of the actions ready for you on the app. A little bit after this, Emily mentions that she can't give a lot of context behind how saves work. She is right. There are three main ones: Reflex, Will, and Fortitude. But you could also have other kinds of saves. Athletic saves, Diplomacy saves, Intimidation saves. The fun rule of thumb that I get to teach you is that every DC is just 10 plus your modifier. Every single one. If you need to know what your Will DC is, it's 10 plus your modifier for Will. So if your modifier for Will is +6, the DC for your Will save is 16. If someone is rolling against your Acrobatics DC, it's your Acrobatics modifier +10. So if you have a really crappy Acrobatics score, like I usually do, of like +1, then the DC to beat is 11. And as Emily pointed out later, all of these modifiers go up with your proficiency, but it will always be 10 plus the modifier to calculate a DC every single time. Okay, now we move on to one of their biggest, toughest pills to swallow, which is probably going to be a big one for any D&D player coming into Pathfinder, which is yes, Pathfinder doesn't have advantage. Kinda. As Emily rightfully points out, there are hero points, which to me gives a lot more agency to players about when they want to choose to succeed. Advantage and disadvantage in D&D is either granted by the GM, or you might have a special ability that says you get advantage. Now, there are definitely abilities that do grant you what you would call advantage. I'll talk about those in a bit. But in the circumstances where a GM would usually have to make the advantage disadvantage call, with hero points, a player gets to make that call whenever they want. As long as they have a hero point, they can make a reroll. If this is too critical a moment to fail, they get to throw down that hero point token if you're at a physical table and do a reroll. They don't have to beg the GM. They don't have to make a case. They just get to do it. Now, that said, there are things that will grant you fortune abilities. Hero points are such a fortune effect, which is a trait that some spells, feats, and pieces of equipment have that modify how you get to roll your dice. With hero points, the fortune effect is you being able to reroll any roll that you put your hero point down for. But there are certain spells and abilities that grant you advantage. Bit of Luck, for example, is a cleric spell, and when you cast it on a willing creature, if they have to make a saving throw, they can roll twice and take the better result. Or like the ranger's focus ability, Hunter's Luck, which when they're trying to recall knowledge, they can roll twice and take the better result. So it's not the same kind of advantage that you might be used to with D&D, where you can do those rerolls at any time as long as it's granted to you. But you always have that power thanks to hero points. The final hard-to-swallow pill that they had was about the multiple attack penalty, which I'm really glad they all got on board with pretty easily. And part of why they got on board with it so easily is because they recognized that the multiple attack penalty is there to make you do things creatively. In fact, you could even say that the multiple attack penalty is at the heart of just about every design aspect of second edition. You're going to hear often that Pathfinder's second edition's math is really tight. That's because every +1 or -1 matters a lot. That goes back to those critical levels of success that we talked about earlier. The DCs and the levels at which you set them. It's the dynamics of teamwork. It's how spells work. The multiple attack penalty isn't just there to slow you down. It's a constant reminder of the stuff that you have to overcome. Every rune on a weapon, every spell that combat buffs, every ability that gives you a circumstance bonus, flanking, position, movement. This dance of math that Gary Gygax has tricked us into loving is at the core of second edition. It's a silent nudge to do something else, to try thinking outside the box. And the game honestly wouldn't be the same without it. That said, it is always an obstacle to overcome, and there are many ways to do it. Now, to answer one of the questions that they ask, no, you are never going to be able to completely rid yourself of the multiple attack penalty, even all the way up at level 20, but you will probably have enough abilities, inherent bonuses, buffs that can be placed on you mid-combat, penalties that can be applied to enemies, that the multiple attack penalty will barely be an obstacle, at least compared to all the other things at high level that are going to start being thrown in. So, as you can see, Emily, if you are listening to this podcast, you didn't get anything wrong. You did awesome, and I am, for one, really proud of you. In fact, because I saw that you have a P.O. box, I sent you a little care package to help you on your adventure into second edition. And what I think you'll find, whether it's you, Emily, who are listening to this, or part of the Nod Nation, I'm sorry if that's not what you guys call yourself. I'm really sorry. But the 2E community is just super helpful. If you use the hashtag Pathfinder2E on Twitter or on TikTok, you are going to get people who are going to respond to you and help you out. The Pathfinder2E subreddit, which I am a mod of, has a weekly mega thread where we will help you with your questions. We also run a yearly event called Beginner's Box Day, where if you want to try out Pathfinder 2nd Edition before you buy it, GMs will run it for you. My podcast goes more in depth with other resources that are available to you. I'm on TikTok. I'm on Twitter mostly. I made Mastodon and Hive, but I've been on there less since Twitter seemed to be mostly fine, even after Elon. Anyway, so yes, whether it's the Not Another D&D crew, whether you are a listener from them, or whether you're one of my regular listeners, or someone who's just listening to this podcast for the first time, Second Edition is a great game. It's an easy game to learn. I try to make it easy for you. There are other great resources. Emily named a couple of them. I'll name a couple more. How It's Played is a great YouTube series that goes over individual rules very in depth, very comprehensively. Another one is Dice Don't Die. That's a podcast where they do deep dives into each of the individual classes. There are too many great actual plays for Pathfinder to mention. I have mentioned a couple: Min-Max, Tabletop Gold, Dice Will Roll, Dragon Punch Squad, Deadly D8. Simply PF2 is brand new on the block, but they are a really cute comic that simplifies the rules. It is a great space to enter, and this is a great time to start. So, no matter who you are, who's listening, try out Second Edition. Try out these resources. Try out more of my podcast. And here is hoping that Emily can convince Brennan to do Dimension 20 Pathfinder 2 next season. But until that season, don't let the rules rule you.